Hello, everyone. Hi, babe.
Hi, babe.
Nice to see you again.
You too. It's been so long.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Rebel Mama Hotline. The Rebel Mama Health Kick rolls on with the help of our amazing partners at Women's Health Collective Canada, aka WHCC. They've set us up with yet another of their brilliant researchers for today's episode, and we couldn't be more excited. Today we'll be speaking to Dr. Joanne Katsopoulos. Dr. Katsopoulos is a scientist with the Familial Breast Cancer Research Unit at the Women's College Research Institute, Women's College Hospital, and an associate professor at the Dalhousie School of Public Health at the University of Toronto.
Dr. Katsopoulos directs a wide range of research initiatives to further our understanding of BRCA-associated breast and ovarian cancer, with the goal of identifying viable, evidence-based strategies that confer substantial risk reduction and improve outcomes. Her studies have demonstrated an important role of hormonal, reproductive, and modifiable exposures on BRCA-associated cancer development. This critical work has provided women and healthcare providers with evidence-based management options while contributing to our understanding of the pathogenesis of hereditary cancer. She also leads several projects aimed to improve our understanding of factors that impact ovarian cancer prognosis. The overall goal of her research is to provide women with a wider choice of less invasive options to reduce their risk of breast and ovarian cancer.
But before we get into the nitty-gritty with Joanne, let's take a quick commercial break from our sponsors.
This episode of the Rebel Mama Hotline was brought to you by the Women's Health Collective of Canada. WHCC was created by three of Canada's leading women's health and hospital foundations to break the barriers holding us back from providing women with the knowledge and care they deserve. Through intentional collaboration, WHCC brings resources, funding, and some of the brightest minds in science and healthcare together to address the wider gaps that we can't tackle on our own. Learn more about who they are and what they do at whcc.ca.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Thank you for joining us, Dr. Katsopoulos. We're really looking forward to hearing about some of your research findings surrounding cancer susceptibility genes, namely BRCA1 and BRCA2, or as you prefer to say, BRCA1 and BRCA2. Can we first talk about what these genetic mutations are, how they come about, and how you find out if you have one?
Okay, well, thank you. I'm very happy to be here. It's very exciting. And I'm happy to talk about something that I've been studying now for 20 years. So call me Joanne, number one. And so BRCA1 and BRCA2, they're known as tumor suppressor genes. So everybody actually has BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes. And they're important because they basically prevent cancer from happening. Oh. So I won't get into like a big biology lecture, but all our genes encode proteins, and proteins all have a role. And the role of BRCA1 and 2 is to fix errors and help errors that happen in our genes. So I'm going to, in our DNA. So I'm going to like bypass that part because that's just too complicated.
Thank you.
But
it's good to know those guys are there doing their work.
Non-biological brains.
So BRCA1 and 2, yeah. So the point is we all have these genes. What's different is that individuals that inherit a mutated copy of the gene, either from their mother or father, so anybody could have a mutated copy of the gene, they have a very high risk of developing cancer. So a mutated copy can come from your mother or your father, and if you're a woman, that increases your risk of developing breast and ovarian cancer. In men, they also have higher lifetime risks of various cancers, like prostate cancer, BRCA2, male BRCA2 mutation carriers can develop male breast cancer. But for the most part, we focus on the women because there's a really high risk of developing the two cancers I spoke about, breast and ovarian cancer.
Okay. Wow. I didn't realize that men had similar mutations that could manifest in cancer for them.
Yes, definitely. And that's really important. And that's often gets lost in our family history. So you have and I think personally, coming from an immigrant family, our family history is a disaster. So you try to get information of what someone developed or what someone died of, you never get the right answer.
Mm, right.
And often we forget about the men. And that's why sometimes it gets lost, because the men aren't predisposed to some of these other cancers and the women are. So if, for example, the man had a mutation but didn't develop disease, but then passed the gene on, the gene mutation to his daughter, you may not realize that it was coming from the father's side or the mother's side. So it's important to know your family history, and it's important to know that men also carry gene mutations.
It's true, though, about the immigrant families and not having that. Yeah. I think, like, now we're getting all of that in check. Like, our kids will be fine with all of that information, but we definitely don't have access. Yeah,
exactly.
Yes. Okay, so does this mean that all cancers could be hereditary, or is it only breast and ovarian for women and prostate for men?
So, no, there's a lot of hereditary predisposition syndromes or hereditary cancer syndromes, however you want to refer to them. All cancers are likely genetic. So they arise because a genetic defect happens, a mutation, and that continues to, that cell will continue to divide and eventually become cancer. But not all cancers are hereditary. So the proportion varies. I would say maybe up to 20%, maybe 25% of cancers are hereditary. And there are different genes which, when mutated, predispose to other cancers. So even though I focus on BRCA1 and 2 and some other genes that are involved in breast and ovarian cancer, there's a lot of other genes that are involved in other cancers, which other individuals study about and learn about and are linked to increasing your risk of developing that disease.
So I have a friend who recently underwent a double mastectomy due to the presence of one of these genes. Her mother had breast cancer, and so she went and did her testing, and they found the gene in her. But from what I understand, your research focuses on less invasive approaches to disease prevention. What might those approaches look like?
Yeah, so that's an example of what your friend did. It was really important. So that was great. Knowledge is power, I think. Mm-hmm. So she knew, she had access to genetic testing. She took the most aggressive approach, which is great for her, that she had a double mastectomy. And a lot of the work in our team, I'm part of a big team, and we have the largest study of mutation carriers in the world. So we follow 19,000 women all over the world. And this was initiated back in 1995 by the director of our unit, Dr. Stephen Narod, who was one of the co-discoverers of the gene, one of the genes. And so what I've been doing is, when I started as a PhD student back in the day, and I continue now, is I try to understand what factors are influencing risk of disease in women who have a mutation. So we know they have a high risk of breast cancer. We know they have a high risk of ovarian cancer. So what can we do with this information we collect from them to try to understand what is either increasing or decreasing the risk? And by studying that, we can try to identify pathways that might be involved in their cancer development. And from those pathways, then maybe we can find some drugs or targets to introduce the idea of using what we say chemo prevention, so using a chemical or a drug to prevent disease.
Okay.
So specifically, so the example you said, mastectomy. So to prevent breast cancer in mutation carriers, a double mastectomy is an option. Mm-hmm. Or you can have intensive screening with MRI imaging. But obviously not a lot of women will have a mastectomy, because that's a drastic approach to preventing disease. And we know that from our research that I would say about 30% of mutation carriers will opt for mastectomy.
So that's still a pretty big number.
It is, and it went up a bit.
Such a drastic surgery.
Yeah, and it went up a bit, and it varies by countries. But then we have the 70% who are having MRI imaging, which is also a good thing, but you're not preventing disease. You're just identifying it, hopefully, at an earlier stage. Mm-hmm. So what about those 70%? So a lot of our work has looked at how hormones and reproductive factors and other items or exposures influence risk. And so we've looked at pathways. So we've found that progesterone-containing hormones or that pathway might increase the risk of breast cancer in mutation carriers. So this is when you kind of take basic science and the type of work we do, which is more epidemiology or clinical work. And when you put that data together, it really supports this idea of blocking this progesterone pathway as a potential way to prevent cancer in high-risk women.
And you do that with drugs?
So I'm sorry if I'm overcomplicating things. So no, yeah, you would hopefully do that. So for example, we found that hormone replacement therapy or HRT that has progestin can increase the risk. And that's been shown in the general population also. But then there's a lot of basic science by a lot of scientists, even those in Toronto, who have found that there's this pathway called RANK that works with progesterone, and it does impact breast development and breast susceptibility. And what's interesting is that there's a drug that actually exists called denosumab, which blocks this pathway, and it's currently used to treat osteoporosis.
Oh, interesting.
So we've been really trying to find a way to potentially fund a clinical trial that we could try using this drug. So it's called repurposing an existing drug to see if we can potentially prevent breast cancer in high-risk women.
Wow. And that drug already exists.
And
so
it
would just be a matter of figuring out the dose.
That's, yeah, exactly. The dose, the regimen, what age you would have to take it. And that's a really good point. Those are really important things to think about.
Right.
But with research, you need funding, and funding is really challenging to get these days. And I have a prevention bias maybe, but there's a lot of interest in treatment of cancer, and I would say a lot less focus in primary prevention.
That's where the focus
really
should be if you think about it, like in a common sense kind of way.
Yeah.
But okay, well, we'll talk about that. We're happy to support that.
Yeah, exactly. Do you want us to help you fundraise?
Sure. Yeah,
we'll take anything we can.
Outside of genetic markers, have there been environmental factors linked to breast and ovarian cancer that our listeners should be aware of?
So there's been a lot of research done all over the world on diet and lifestyle and so on. But I wouldn't say there's a magic pill or a magic nutrient. There are factors that are known to increase or decrease risk. I would say the most established in general. So I'm talking about non-mutation carriers, because we have to think of general population and high-risk women separately.
Right.
Because the baseline population risk of developing cancer is much lower than a mutation carrier. But we know that alcohol, for example, is a risk factor.
Damn it. Thanks, Joanne.
But you also,
in particular, yeah.
So you have to also put it into context, right? You're increasing your risk, but if your baseline risk is low, then the added risk isn't as substantial as sometimes the news makes it.
Right.
And there's reproductive factors that are protective. And I know you said environment, but you know, like breastfeeding, having children, those factors have been known to decrease cancer risk. And those studies are important because they're showing, again, what is happening in the breast when you breastfeed or when you take hormones or when you have a child that is either causing it, is changing the breast to either prevent cancer from happening or increasing the risk. And then for ovarian cancer, we know for a very long time that oral contraceptives decrease the risk of ovarian cancer in high-risk women and in the general population.
They decrease the risk?
Yes.
Wow.
By half.
Wow.
Take your birth control, ladies. Yeah,
so birth control is actually something that it's important in general, you know, for contraception, number one. But number two, it is a strong protective factor for ovarian cancer.
Is that oral only, or is that, does that apply to all of the contraceptive options?
So that's a very good question. And
So
we are also, our team and others are looking at contemporary, so IUDs and different formulations. And so there's a signal that the same effect exists, but it's harder to be as precise because these are really newer methods of contraceptive. And so we're going to have to take some time to revisit the literature and continue to look at it. But I would say the signal is likely the same.
Right.
But the one thing when we were talking about breast, but when we think about ovarian cancer, some of these studies are hard to do in general because ovarian cancer is very rare in the general population. So unlike breast cancer, which is more common, so a woman has an 11% lifetime risk, so maybe like 1 in 10 or 1 in 11, whereas ovarian cancer, the lifetime risk is like 1.4%.
Oh.
So ovarian cancer is very rare.
Unless you have one of these genetic mutations.
Unless you have a mutation.
Right.
And other gene mutations also predispose to ovarian cancer. There's other genes that are known, like RAD51C and some other genes that exist.
Okay.
So there are a few other genes also. And so because ovarian cancer is rare, some of these studies are harder to conduct because you don't have a big number of women.
Right.
Okay. But ovarian cancer, unlike breast, has no way to screen for ovarian cancer, which is why ovarian cancer has a very high mortality rate.
Mm. Right. Yeah.
This is all fascinating so far.
Yeah. I mean, our next question was going to be about hormonal contraceptives and ovarian cancer, but you've already answered it. So we'll move along to menopause.
Yay.
Menopause is a hot topic.
Oh, yeah.
Very hot topic.
Like, really hot. No pun intended. So for a long time, there was a lot of misleading information floating around about the correlation between hormone replacement therapy and risk of cancer for women. Mm-hmm. What is the most recent science telling us about that?
Okay, yeah, and I'm sure many of your listeners read the New York Times article,
exactly.
and nothing was new there, but it's unfortunate that women have been suffering through menopause for the past few decades because of misinterpretation of older studies. So there were two large clinical trials, the Women's Health Initiatives, that were conducted several years ago, and they found that there was an increased risk of breast cancer in women who were taking estrogen and progesterone-containing hormone replacement therapy, or HRT, or menopausal hormone therapy, however you want to refer to it.
The combo of the two.
Yes. And yeah. so they stopped those trials. And so everybody was in panic mode. And from there came a decline in using hormone replacement therapy in women to help through the menopause transition. So that was unfortunate, because since then they've done a lot of reevaluation of the literature, and those trials find they were important. And we do know that progesterone or progestin, which is a synthetic,
right,
the more harmful part of the progesterone containing HRTs, we know that it has an impact on breast cancer risk. But the difference is that these trials were done in older women. Their average age was 60, where you would...
And
there's no real indication,
like
whereas menopause, yeah. So for high-risk women, it can start abruptly after they have their ovaries removed.
Right.
But if we talk about the general population, if you're transitioning in your late 40s, early 50s, the idea of hormone replacement therapy is to help a woman transition.
And that transition period is so important. We just had this conversation with Colleen too. It's just like, it's important to take into account that whole transition period and help yourself, not just like that specific year that your period stops.
Exactly. And it's really, and now there's been a lot of literature and a lot of individuals. So there's a lot of reasons for that. So there was misinformation and misinterpretation of these trials. Then physicians were afraid to prescribe. Women were afraid to use it.
Yeah.
Then there was a lack of proper educating of clinicians on the use of HRT and being able to, you know, identify, you know, if you have a history of blood clots, you should take one regimen and not the other. So now we really need to push for, like, I think patients need to be advocates. If you're you shouldn't have to suffer through menopause. The idea is to use menopausal hormone therapy to get you through that, but not, the idea isn't to be on it till you're 80, right? You're not meant to stay in your premenopausal state.
Yeah. So that's when the hormones are the most useful, right? Is in like the pre and kind of leading up phase. And then once you're kind of through the bulk of it, then you're supposed to taper off.
So I am not a clinician, number one. So I never want to, I have to say that as a caveat. But no, I think the idea is that when we work with our clinician partners at Women's College, we have a lot of menopause specialists. The idea is that every woman is different. Some women don't ever experience menopausal symptoms. So not everybody has to take hormones, but for women that are, you know, having sleep disturbance, hot flashes, whatever their symptoms are, there's ways to manage them. Unfortunately, someone who have had breast cancer can't take HRT, which we see a lot in our cohort of high-risk women. So they've had breast cancer, they've had their ovaries removed, they've been forced into surgical menopause before age 40, somebody's 35. So what can they take? Now, that's the group of women that we worry about, because they're young at menopause and they can't take hormones. And so that's something we're studying right now to see if there's other options for these women.
Yes, because we just had a conversation with Dr. Norris about women's heart health.
Mm-hmm.
And sleep disturbance is a huge factor. So if your sleep is disturbed at night because of your menopause symptoms, then you're at a higher risk for heart issues going forward. Like, this is, women just love to be like, I slept for 2 hours last. Like, it, we tend to brush it off.
Exactly.
As just like a thing that we're all going through, but it's actually incredibly dangerous.
Yeah, estrogen. And I mean, it impacts your bone health, your heart health, your brain health.
Yeah.
And that's established literature. It's nothing new.
So women's hormones obviously fluctuate so much throughout our lives, depending on what our major life events are.
Good times. Good times.
We're so lucky. So are there times in our lives when we are more susceptible to developing cancers than others because of what our hormones are doing?
So, yeah, good question. And how do I say this without making it convoluted? So it's, when we talk about, so I often think of breast and ovarian together because I think of high-risk women. But if we're thinking more general, yeah, your breast goes through various phases of development during puberty, during pregnancy, during breastfeeding, during menopause. And so there's development and regression.
They go through so much.
I know. Development, regression, exactly. And so, and that's all based on hormones, right? Yeah. As the hormones cause the cells to expand and evolve or regress. And so there's, it has been shown, and it's very theoretical, that as the cells like multiply, so if you're proliferating because of the hormones, you're more likely to acquire a genetic mutation.
Okay.
So that's why it's been shown that at the time of rapid, a lot of hormonal exposure and rapid development of the breast, you're more likely to acquire a mutation. Mm. But it's kind of contradictory when you think of it, because that happens during pregnancy. But then something also happens with all these hormones that causes the breast to develop and expand that also confers protection. So it's kind of like a double-edged sword. Okay. So yes, hormone, there are certain periods of your life. And that's why we sometimes hear about pregnancy-associated breast cancers also, and likely attributed to the high hormonal milieu of the breast at the time of the pregnancy. So yeah, there definitely hormones are playing a role.
So, but when you... if you're pregnant, obviously your body starts producing milk. You decide you want to nurse. It's the actual act of nursing. Like, is it something that, is it the, like how the baby's saliva communicates
or the with glands the mom's, like, or maybe?
Is
or
that like part of it? Or is it production? Just the fact that like the milk leaves your body?
It's like the physiology and the ductal development. Okay. And
then that's what insulates.
But there's lots of theories. Like, there's theories of, like, clearance of carcinogens.
I'm getting flashbacks.
Like, getting rid of...
like, your boobs aching.
My, like, bleeding nipples from back in the day.
Like, honestly, like, there's so many theories. Like, it's likely the physiologic changes that happen. But then there's also, yeah, like, the theories of clearing carcinogens when you're breastfeeding. And
right. And does it have a different... like, does it make a difference how long you breastfeed for?
I'm trying to think of, we did a study on breastfeeding because that's also protective in high-risk women.
Right.
I think you have to say like that someone breastfed at least 6 months, I would say.
Okay. To have that insulating effect.
But I'm sure there's a monthly effect.
Right. Yeah, exactly. But everyone says that like whatever you can is, like just do whatever you
and
can.
There's, but when you talk about the general population, like the baseline level is still low enough.
Right.
For high-risk women, we also see an effect, but that's where the interpretation is different. A breastfeeding won't prevent her. Like, her cancer risk is so high because of the mutation, it's hard to identify something that's going to...
breastfeeding won't be.
It's important to know that, and I'm not saying they shouldn't breastfeed, but it's also provided more insight into what is it happening in the breast that can, you know, be a target potentially later on.
Right.
We're going to be so smart after all of this.
I don't know. I feel like I'm messing up.
No.
I'm not being very clear. I'm sorry. Too many. I need a whiteboard.
Yeah. We'll bring one in next time. You can draw your cells on it for us. Mm-hmm. And we can look at it like, what? Just like in high school.
No, I feel empowered by all this knowledge. And I hope that's the takeaway for our listeners too. But before we wrap up, our audience is between the ages of 25 and 45, mostly women, mostly moms. Is there anything that has sprung from your research that you think the specific demographic needs to know that we haven't covered, or like any takeaways they can have from this conversation that are important?
So I think the main thing is to, like I already said, knowledge is power. Knowing your family history and knowing whether or not you have a, like, our group is really for population-based genetic testing. We feel that everybody has a right to know if they are a mutation carrier or not, because then you can actually do something to prevent disease and prevent death. Unfortunately, right now in Ontario, you have to satisfy certain criteria to qualify to get genetic testing.
Right.
And the criteria, you know, they involve a strong family history of cancer or a young onset breast cancer. There's a bunch of criteria. And we're trying to move away from that because genetic testing has become cheaper, faster, easier to access.
Yeah, it should be more accessible.
And unfortunately, we don't have that in Ontario. So right now we're doing a study called the screenproject.ca, the Screen Project, where unfortunately there is a small cost because it covers the cost of genetic testing. But we're trying to evaluate in a research setting whether accessing genetic testing in a different way, where you can just go online, sign up, but still have the same resources. So we weren't talking a lot about genetic testing here, but we're trying to change the way genetic testing is accessed so that it's accessible to everybody. So this way you sign up for genetic testing, you have your pre-test counseling video, you send us we send you a kit, you spit in it, we send it away in like a week, you know your genetic test result.
Oh my God, that's all you need.
It's a spit test. And then you're referred appropriately. Because right now genetic counseling is so resource heavy. You have to get referred. So we miss a lot of people. That's the problem. You miss, if you don't know your family history or you don't qualify, usually people don't know till someone dies or has a cancer and now they qualify. So then you have to book your appointment, drive to the genetic counselor, have an appointment, give a blood sample, wait, go back for your result. There's a lot of time spent counseling in the beginning when only a small subset are going to be positive and need more follow-up care.
Right.
So it doesn't mean we're not getting rid of pre-test counseling, but we've made a video with the genetic counselor, which makes sense.
Trying to make it more accessible.
Yeah. And so we're really trying to push towards population-based genetic testing because we can only prevent those that we know about, and we only know who will develop cancer, and it'll be most likely in the high-risk population. So at least those women can get referred on to MRI imaging or to preventive surgery.
Yeah.
We talked a lot about breast, but we really worry about the ovarian cancer risk because ovarian cancer, like I said, there's no screening. It's diagnosed very late and most women will die of the disease.
But so, to your point, the focus should be on prevention. Absolutely.
So how can people advocate for the prevention?
So knowing your family history.
But how can we advocate for your version of the prevention? Whereas with the, like digital screening and the spit test, like this just makes a lot of sense.
I mean, is there any campaigns we can get behind, or is there places that?
Oh, definitely. Women's College Hospital. We have our foundation and if anybody wants to know, and I know, unfortunately it is a cost. It's a couple hundred dollars. But it's, you know, we have to remember it's a one-time test. Like you do it once in your life. You don't have to repeat it.
Yeah.
We pay more to get our vitamin D tests every year.
I pay more for like dinner PSA. In Toronto.
And I know that's
one grocery shop.
So I think if you want to know, go ahead and do the study. And I think we're slowly trying as a team to show in a research setting that we're not causing harm. People are happy to know. And this way we're capturing a lot of men who don't want to come for testing. We always think about the one man who signed up who was like living in the Northern Ontario. You know, he didn't want to. Why should you drive into a city? Like, then there's not that many genetics clinics in Canada.
Right.
It makes it challenging.
There's years of backlog.
Yeah,
of course. So what website can people go to if they are interested in doing this?
It should be the screenproject.ca.
We will link it in our show notes.
It's on the Women's College Hospital. I can double check.
We'll find it.
Yes, we'll find it and we'll make sure it's in our show notes.
Okay.
So okay. I think women have to be, and men, everybody has to be their own advocate. But I think it's important to use the knowledge. And if you know you have a family history, go to your family doctor and get referred to a genetics clinic.
Yeah, that's a good tip too.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my God. Well, thank you so much
for coming
down here.
I hope I didn't confuse your audience more.
No, I don't think so at all. And I think that the resources that we will link are going to be really valuable. And if people want to stay up to date on your latest findings, can they follow you somewhere online?
Yeah. So our website, actually, we do a lot at Women's College Communications and we do have a website. So I'll pass that on to you. But for those who are interested in hereditary cancer, we have over COVID developed a virtual seminar series where every month we've had a guest speaker who's an expert in the field target a lot of different areas. And we did 3 seasons of this and everything is on YouTube and it was all posted. So it's been amazing for those that may be interested because they have a family history and all sorts of topics, menopause management, genetic testing.
Amazing. Okay, so we'll link that for sure as well, because that's going to be really valuable for people too. And then are you on Twitter or anything like that?
Oh my God, I'm going to be embarrassed and say no.
Don't be.
But I let Women's College deal with it.
Good on you. We like that, protecting yourself. Awful? Those are some good boundaries. No, we think it's wonderful.
Yeah.
My Facebook says I'm engaged.
She has no handle.
Her Facebook says she's engaged.
Like that's from 25 she's got years like... ago. I have Instagram, but that's boring. It's just my kids.
Yeah, exactly. No, if people want your research, we will direct them to Women's College Hospital.
Yes, or to me directly. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay, awesome.
And as always, we recommend that everyone follows WHC Canada on Instagram and check into www.whcc.ca often and stay informed as new research comes to light from their incredible network of doctors and clinicians.
If you liked what you heard today, you're in luck because there's more coming. Thanks to our amazing partners at WHCC, we're hosting a total of 3 researchers this season, so make sure to follow or subscribe so you don't miss one.
As always, we'd love for you to like, rate, and review this podcast wherever you listen, and feel free to share it with a friend who you think would benefit from it, aka everyone.
This podcast was produced by Space Monkey inside the Soda Studio. The song you're listening to is called Name a Number off the debut album Unrequited by Roshan. Stream it now on Apple Music.